You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Hang Up and Listen is sponsored by Bombas. Bombas are athletic leisure socks re-engineered to look better, feel better, and perform better with a mission to help those in need. One pair purchased equals one pair donated. Go to bombas.com/hang and get a free pair with your order or 20% off. That's bombas.com/hang. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of January 12th, 2015. On this week's show, we will talk about the divisional round of the NFL playoffs, which centered on such existential questions as, what is a catch? And who is Peyton Manning, really? We'll also be joined by ESPN's Tom Haberstroh to talk about strange times in the NBA's Eastern Conference, where the Atlanta Hawks have the best record, and the Detroit Pistons have won 8 of 9 games after dumping the very highly paid Josh Smith. Andrew Basharat will be here to explain what's going on in Yosemite, where a pair of climbers are attempting the first free ascent of El Capitan's Don Wall. And in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we'll discuss the miserable and also kind of hilarious state of the 5-35 New York Knicks and the New York Times' decision to pull their writer off the beat to give him, quote, a break from such woeful basketball. Joining me in Washington, D.C., Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic, and the Friday sports correspondent for NPR's All Things Considered. Hello, Stefan.
Hi, Josh.
With us from New York is Mike Pesca, host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist, with Mike Pesca. Hello, Mike.
I disagree with the Times assessment. I mean, half the teams playing each night are playing a splendid brand of basketball, unimpeded by the other team's defense or ability to score.
Plus segment, Mike. That's the kind of insight that Slate members are paying for.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to give everyone a taste, to wet their beak on my plus knowledge, but it'll end there. Everything else is behind a firewall of intellect.
You'll get such X-rated content as wet your beak on my plus knowledge in the member segment. So I, for the first time ever, was on a frozen body of water on my 2 feet. This weekend, the canal froze over in D.C., which happens sometimes, although less often than it used to, given the warmer state of our planet. And for people who grew up in the northern part of the country, this might not be that interesting of an event.
But
it felt very Rockwellian to me. There were, like, people out skating along. I, on the other hand, was wearing tennis shoes, but was enlisted into a 3-on-3 ice hockey game as the guy in shoes, which made me think, you know the expression, like, a guy is out there on roller skates?
Yeah.
It was actually the sensation of being the guy who didn't have skates on. Very similar to being the only person who has skates on, just being the outlier. There are just lots of people skating around me while I kind of just, like, stuck a stick out occasionally.
You didn't move very much because it's dangerous to move in tennis shoes.
I tried to run. I tried to run back and forth a little bit, but it was futile.
Did
but I
fall?
Made a very good obstacle for the other players.
So you were like a human.
It was sort of like being a tree in the school play.
Traffic cone.
I was a traffic cone, a human traffic cone.
The idiom should be like a New Orleanian on a frozen canal. Oh, he was moving like a New Orleanian on a frozen canal.
In tennis shoes.
Yeah.
That was.
I say sneakers. I think maybe if you say tennis shoes, you're even worse. On
That's why I said it.
Water.
Yeah.
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 Have, wait, you've been ice skating, though, on an ice rink.
One time? Yeah. When would I have had the opportunity to do this? I mean, I guess I've lived up here for a while. But what, if you've never...
They have this thing called indoor rinks everywhere.
But there was not such a thing in New Orleans. And if you're not
really?
On... No. And if you're not on skates for the first, like, 22 to 28
years
of your life, you kind of...
All right,
it's kind of hard to learn.
You didn't go to Brown until you were 22?
Yeah, I guess they had an ice rink there. Look, I haven't been on skates. I don't know what to tell you.
Much like a dangerous playing surface, we are poking holes in your theory.
You're not going to get me to confess that I have, in fact, been on skates, but I don't know if I have a good reason for it.
But yet your nickname was Skates, although that was a tribute to Ronaldo Nehemiah, Skeets.
Does this already count as whimsy watch? So in the Ravens-Pats game, Dan Randleman pointed out on Twitter that a referee fell over.
There was more Andrew Luck complimenting defenders.
Did we catch that?
I think they mentioned it. It was mentioned, but only because it's gone viral.
No, whimsy
it's
watch.
It's got to be.
This is whimsy watch. New York bozo. That's whimsy watch. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah. That was Aaron Rodgers' audible call. Yeah. After the game, he said it didn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it just meant to amuse the fans at home. If that's the case, definitely whimsy watch. If it was only for amusement. Maybe it was a reference
and
to
if it, was it spontaneous?
The tri-state area bozo Chris Christie. Pointed
was it,
political reference.
Was it spontaneous? Was he implying that it was spontaneous, New York bozo, or was it part of the signal call?
He says our guys don't know what it means either. Nobody knew what it meant. It didn't obviously mean anything.
What would you possibly call the governor of New Jersey a New York bozo? Also, Aaron Rodgers supported defunding the ARC tunnel, so I think he likes Christie.
Maybe that's what Aaron Rodgers wants you to think, that he wasn't referring to Chris Christie. It's like PSYOPs move. Also, Julie Kirsten pointed out on our Facebook page, Cam Chancellor hurdling the line to try to block a field goal twice. That was my favorite moment of the weekend. That was whimsical. Like, it made just a regular field goal attempt. It injected a certain frisson that is usually lacking. They should make a rule. They're talking about narrowing the goalposts, whatever. They should require one defensive player to try to leap over the line.
Or they
every
should
play.
Put a little trampoline behind the defensive line, sort of like what the gorilla uses in Phoenix to dunk a basketball.
I just had this great idea. I think audible should be assigned to every quarterback remaining in the playoffs based on a Republican potential presidential nominee. Mm-hmm. Mormon retread! Arkansas fat man! Nepotistic has been on two!
Great audibles. I look forward to seeing those this coming weekend. But you know who will not be audibling? Tony Romo. The man will audible no more. On fourth down, late in the Green Bay-Dallas game, Dez Bryant of the Cowboys leaped in there to catch a pass from Romo. He landed at the Packers' one-yard line. I did say catch. I would like to use another word besides catch there, but it is hard to come up with another word.
The NFL needs to create a word for what happened.
It was a catch-like substance, a catch-like process. He did not complete the full process, according to referee Gene Steratore, because the ball became dislodged as he went to the ground before Bryant could perform an act common to the game, also known as a football move, a gridiron gesture, a pigskin thing. This is known as the Calvin Johnson rule. After a play in 2010 when Calvin Johnson caught a pass and it was ruled that it wasn't a catch because of that whole going to the ground football move thing, the consensus out in the world seems to be that this is a bad rule that was applied correctly by the refs. What do you think, Pesca?
I think that the NFL uses extra verbiage and extra words when the perfectly good word, like catch, they want to try to define as not applying.
You can take out the I think and just say the NFL uses. Yeah. Go ahead.
After the game, Dez Bryant chewed his meal, but a little bit dribbled out of the corner of his mouth. And then said, nope, not a chew. Doesn't count as nutrition. Yeah, so I guess... It is good to have Mike Pereira there to tell us that this injustice is actually justice and it wasn't fair. And what an injustice from a common sense point of view. It was Tuck Rule level injustice, I think. Like, that's in the rule book? That seems freaking weird. Although the Tuck Rule was eventually and essentially upheld and people just were told this is what it means. I guess people know what a catch is, but so it does seem that I understand what a football move is, and I understand controlling it while you go to the ground, but he controlled it part of the way in the ground, on the ground. He just has to control it all the way through the ground. It seems like there's a higher standard of catches that go to the ground as opposed to catches that are made without going to the ground, and why should that be? I don't understand that.
Well, it's his fault for going to the ground in the first place. So the win probability went from 56% for Dallas if that had been ruled a completed catch on the 1 yard line, Dallas down by 5 with around 4 minutes to go, to 81% for Green Bay. So I guess that was a 37% shift from 56% for Dallas to 19% for Dallas. Stefan, one argument that I've seen out there is that, yes, this is a bad rule, but, you know, it's really hard to formulate a different one when you actually have the task of putting in words in the rule book. It's easy to mock the NFL for having all this verbiage, but how else do you define a catch if not this way?
I don't know. And that's the problem, right? The problem is that you can clearly see he catches the ball, he controls the ball, and when he hits the ground, it comes out of his hands. So the NFL has to define this one way or another. And if the other way is catches the ball, maintains possession as he's falling, then it becomes a judgment call. So if you apply that standard, then what do? Then you go to what we were talking about last week on the show, which is maybe every play should be reviewable, that everything should be challengeable, or maybe everything should just be reviewable if the refs decide to make it reviewable, because it's a complicated game that is played at incredibly high speeds that involves judgments that occur in milliseconds by athletes. And one of the arguments that was being made on the post-game show, and Michael Strahan made it, was that, well, what he should have done, what Dez Bryant should have done, was just tuck the ball in his arms and fall to the ground, as if in that, you know, microsecond, he would have had the wherewithal to think, well, maybe should I try to score a touchdown because I really can't tell whether I'm a yard from the goal line or 6 inches from the goal line because I've just made one of the most acrobatic, incredible catches in the NFL this year. So, you know, he's operating on instinct. So what's the instinct? The instinct is to catch the ball, reach out, and try to score.
Well,
but the rule says that that didn't count as a football move. So it's got to be defined one way. This doesn't seem like a terrible way to define it for me because, yeah, he lost control of the ball because he hit the ground when he hit the ground.
I came away from this with the exact opposite feeling. It's that, like, we all are watching on TV. We perceive it to be a catch. The referee, the whatever line judge who's standing right there, rules it a catch. And then you actually literally have the announcers praising Mike McCarthy for making a great challenge. And then
all the focus
goes away from the catch onto the coach for making a great challenge. Like, the coach is the hero.
Part of the game. Yeah. Right. And what the NFL wants, which is it to be an exercise in forensic videography. I mean, that's the ultimate thing for the NFL, the NFL wants.
So Peter King, who is as plugged into the conventional wisdom of the league as anyone, reports this morning that this gets discussed every offseason. And what the competition committee always comes back to is, okay, we can define a catch as just receiver gets 2 feet down and possesses the ball, which Dez Bryant did.
And then whatever happens after that happens.
But then, you know, there's concern trolling about what King refers to as the cheap fumble. So Bryant catches the ball, has 2 feet down, and then, like, immediately fumbles the ball after that. And then you get into another, like, kind of question of microseconds of, like, how long do you have to have the ball? Like, there's not going to be any way to define it so it's satisfying to everyone, but we know for a fact that this is unsatisfying, and so it seems like it's worth looking at and maybe trying to move to the 2 feet down with the ball standard.
So I think what we'd want to move to is the standard that you're suggesting, Josh, which is we want to reward the great athletic play. We want to reward the great sports act.
Right. We don't want to reward the coach who's aware of the stupid rule and knows how to apply it correctly.
You know, I think there's an interesting opportunity for someone who's at the intersection of football or football rulemaking and jurisprudence, because it seems like the Supreme Court has this choice too. American legal systems, justice, questions of justice often hinge on how clear do you want to make the law. And it might be frustrating to an outsider when the standards before the Supreme Court are things like, you know, clear and compelling. Well, what does that mean? And burden of proof and unusual punishment. But the reason that they have these wiggle phrases is not so that justice doesn't get applied and not so it's not applied evenly. It's to allow for justice to get applied. Now, it doesn't seem like football would ever embrace that, but why not? You know, I wouldn't be, not just because it's a huge game, but I would not be annoyed if the ruling was it is a catch, because, like, we all know what a catch is, and that's a catch. And you could write that into the rule in a way with sort of vague phrases. Like, you could say football move and you could say controlling it, but there could be a supra rule, which says, however, if in the judgment of the on-field and booth officials that this constitutes what is commonly thought of as a catch, then it shall be deemed a catch henceforth.
Well, we know the NFL would never do that, because you saw, like, last week with the Lions-Cowboys game and the perception that the league was favoring the Cowboys. So I think for the league's sake, they want the deniability of having a bright line rule, even in situations where a bright line is just impossible to create.
And I don't even think it's for reasons of deniability alone. I think it's also just how the brains of the people that work at the NFL for a long time function. They function with the belief that everything has to be micromanaged, that this is a league that thrives on specificity.
They make a lot of football moves.
It's literally lower order thinking. And there's, like, a cap to how, I understand it's sports. Maybe you don't want things like evaluation and synthesis or whatever is on top of those pyramids, but it's just lower order thinking. And you can't get higher in the world of the NFL, especially. Whereas, like, baseball, maybe you can. Balls and strikes, wiggle room. That's
cool. I mean, the NFL has always been about trying to eliminate as much spontaneity as possible, whether it's in the celebrations of the athletes or in their minute movements on the field. And this just falls into the nature of the sport, how it's played, and how it's adjudged.
So there was another debate about fairness in a game over the weekend, and that was in the Patriots-Ravens game, where John Harbaugh, the Ravens coach, complained after the game about a series of three plays that the Patriots ran in which they took a running back and lined him up as a lineman, as an ineligible receiver. It was some formational trickery within the rules, as explained by NFL apparatchik Dean Blandino, who has a fantastic name for an NFL apparatchik. Harbaugh was complaining essentially that they weren't given enough time to adjust because this is something that had not been seen before. They didn't have a chance to identify, okay, this is a guy who's on the line of scrimmage. This is a guy who's off the line of scrimmage. It seemed to me like totally fair play, and it was key to the Patriots' comeback from, you know, 14 points down twice. Mike, did you have any thoughts on the Patriots' strategy there?
Yeah, I think it was Belichickian and smart. And explain why it was a complaint with an ethical dimension to me again.
I don't know if it had an ethical dimension. I think it was a complaint about whether the rules were applied correctly, because you know how the referee stands over the ball if there are substitutions made to give the defense a chance to line up.
The defense has the opportunity to make the final substitution,
yes.
Correct?
So the referee in this game announced, like, Shane Vereen, whatever his number is an ineligible receiver.
34.
And then, according to Harbaugh, the Patriots just, like, rush out of the huddle, like, line up, and they don't get a chance to actually see where the different guys are lined up. They're all confused. So it's, I guess, a question of what matching up means. What is a catch? See, well, what is matching up?
Once you allege
what are rules?
Once you allege deception, that to me seems to have an ethical dimension, and it just seems to be Harbaugh was outsmarted and yelled about it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Jason Garrett, after the game, did the very magnanimous thing, or at least the thing that will get you praised for being magnanimous, is saying, like, I didn't agree with the call, but the game wasn't decided by a single play.
Kind of was.
Really?
That Amendola, like it was.
Edelman to Amendola toss and catch seemed to be pretty big. Brandon LaFell, if he dropped the ball, that would have been big.
The game is always decided by a single play.
Yeah, every game that ends by 8 points or fewer literally is decided by a single play. You can't say that that's not
true. And I will tell the coach after each game what that play was, and then he will have to come up with a explanation for whether that play was just or unjust.
I can only hope that the NFL takes this seriously, reviews the tapes, and then promptly destroys them.
The Brady to Edelman to Amendola play had to be the most Patriots play in the history of Patriots plays.
Explain.
Three quarterbacks, basically. I mean, Amendola, I guess.
Let's call him a quarterback. I bet he played quarterback at some level.
He must have played quarterback at some level.
He's probably played catch before.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
An out-of-position guy making his career out of position, Julian Edelman. And, you know, it was just a very Patriots play.
But also, I think that they were right in saying they've been holding on to this one for years. Like, Edelman was a former quarterback, never attempted a pass.
In the NFL, I was surprised by that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That happened at LSU. They had this guy, Russell Shepard, who was an all-star high school quarterback. And every game for his entire career was like, this is the game where this guy's going to throw a pass. Never threw a pass. The genius of Les Miles. They were always expecting it, and he just never did it.
Speaking of the NFL. Go ahead.
Did anyone have tape of him throwing? Like, could he actually throw the ball?
There are all these, like, high school tapes, unless it was, like, a different guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, who am I to say whether it was actually him?
Now, in the vein of the NFL's uber control, I think two things happened during the games over the weekend that bear mentioning. And one is Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth doing that incredible play acting.
The Mueller report showed that the NFL, we are being controlled by Roger Goodell. Yeah, it definitely seemed like people were like holding guns to their heads, asking them to say that it showed that the league office didn't have the Ray Rice tape and that nobody, what did Collinsworth say? Nobody has ever questioned Roger Goodell's
integrity.
Yeah, nobody's ever done that.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the second one was the fact that they didn't show any shots of Jerry Jones and Chris Christie during the Cowboys-Packers game, which, again, points out the level of the control freak level that the NFL feels necessary in the staging of their games. And I think any sentient viewer looks at that and thinks, boy, the NFL, how transparent do they think we are? Well, they think that, you know, we're incredibly stupid, the audience, which is why they would have Al Michaels read that incredibly long press release, not thinking that anyone would question it or not caring that anyone would question it or thinking that 98% of the 35 million people that are watching that game are not going to question it. And the other 5%, well, who cares about those people? They don't like us anyway.
Pascoe, what did you think of the Mueller report, which came out last week and did absolve the NFL of having seen the in elevator Ray Rice video? You know,
they examined all of Roger Goodell's cell phone records and email records, you know.
Refuted the AP report that somebody in the NFL office had acknowledged receipt of it.
And how they did that was amazing, in that they got the date that the AP reported the call happened. They logged every single call that went into and out of the NFL. They called every single person, including the report said, many local restaurants, and they determined that none of those people were. They made, I think there were like well over 1,000 calls in and out, and some were duplicates. So they made 900 calls to track it, which was, I guess, you know, touted as a triumph of how hard the Mueller report worked. And to that extent, it was, except, my God, working for the NFL must suck. I hope they pay these secretaries tons of money so that someone could come in and retrace every call that you make, whatever, to your psychologist, to your endocrinologist, doesn't matter, to your dying mom. I think the Mueller report was this weird thing where the word you used was absolved, right? As much as we all talked about how that was this false choice that if Goodell had really seen the tape, like the AP reported, he'd be out. But of course, it's much more indicting that he didn't really go through any effort to ask. And as the Mueller report showed, the Ravens had it. Revel Casino had it. They never asked Revel. They never asked the Ravens. They were incurious and imperious.
And Detsman did a nice breakdown of one of the NFL's investigators. You know, it's a retired cop who basically punted. I mean, he barely did anything during the course of this. Well, he's monitoring developments in the case, which meant that he was, you know, reading the Trentonian to see what was going on.
But they weren't, because they were only relying on police sources. So they were also criticized for, you know, not going to the casino itself, not going to the team, not going to the lawyers. And the Mueller report doesn't come out and quite glaringly blast them for that, but it certainly paints a picture of it's very curious that they went through so little to actually see this tape that was seen by so many people.
Right.
But another interesting note, the Inside Basketball message board had the details of this before any news organization did. Did you know that?
I knew it after you told me. Does that count?
That was the PESCO report of the Mueller report.
So we didn't get a chance to talk about Peyton Manning. We didn't talk about Seattle. It was a busy weekend for the
Andrew
NFL.
Luck.
Andrew Luck. These are all interesting, important NFL things that we will talk about.
Aaron Rodgers.
At a date in the future. But today's episode is sponsored by Bombas, athletic leisure socks re-engineered to look better, feel better, and perform better. What do you need in a pair of socks? He asked rhetorically. You need them to cover your feet in some kind of material. You don't want them to have built-in, sharp, pointy things that will hurt you.
Shards of glass would be bad.
That would be bad. Bombas do not have those. What do you want in a pair of socks? You want them to come in a bunch of different colors, heather gray accented in lightning yellow, perhaps. You want them to have an extra layer of support and comfort that's not bulky or suffocating. You don't want an irritating seam on the toe. You want them to stay cool in the summer and warm in the winter, thanks to Peruvian Pima cotton. You probably want to get a great deal and perhaps help other people in the process. Bombas meets all of those criteria. Good sock-wanting people of Earth. Go to bombas.com/hang, and you can get a free pair of these awesome socks with your order, or you can get 20% off on your order. Bombas also donates a pair of socks for each pair that you buy, so you can feel good about buying socks that feel good on your feet. Go to bombas.com/hang and get yourself a pair, or buy some for someone you think deserves the best sock-wise. For each pair you buy, Bombas will donate socks to those in need. That's bombas.com/hang. All right, moving on to basketball. The Western Conference standings mostly make sense to the casual or not casual NBA fan. The top eight teams, Golden State, Portland, Houston, Memphis, Dallas, Clippers, San Antonio, Phoenix, these are all good teams. They have good players. Oklahoma City, with Kevin Durant now back from injury, is coming on fast. But the East is just weird. The Cavs have sunk to 500. They've lost five in a row with LeBron James out. They have been passed by the Milwaukee Bucks, who finished 15-67 last year. Then they got a great star rookie draft pick, Jabari Parker. He tore his ACL. And their highest paid player, Larry Sanders, is rumored to not want to play basketball anymore. This team has a better record than the Cavs. At the top of the Eastern standings are Atlanta and Toronto, followed by the Chicago Bulls, makes sense, and the Washington Wizards. The hottest team in the conference is the Detroit Pistons, who have won 8 of 9 after starting 5-23, the turning point being their decision to dump their highest paid player, Josh Smith, and get absolutely nothing in return, no draft picks, no players, no nothing, just $14 million out the door. Joining us to explain or try to explain what is going on here is Tom Haberstroh, who writes about basketball for ESPN.com. Welcome, Tom.
What's up, guys?
What is up is that I am confused about the Eastern Conference and hoping that you can explain it to me. Let's start with the Hawks. They gave the Pacers a scare in the first round of the playoffs last year, but they finished the regular season 38-44. This year, they're kind of closing in on 38 already. They're 29-8. They're led by Jeff Teague, Paul Millsap, Al Horford, and Kyle Korver. Korver is shooting 52.4% on threes, which would be second best all time behind Kyle Korver of 5 years ago. The Hawks coach is Mike Budenholzer, who spent 18 seasons with San Antonio before going to Atlanta. People have started calling the Hawks Spurs East. Is it that simple, Tom? Or are they just like playing Spurs basketball, and that's good enough to be the best team in the Eastern Conference?
Well, what's funny is I was on air the other day at ESPN, and I made the joke, and it's kind of relevant right now. It's like, people call this team Spurs East, but I think we should be calling the Spurs Hawks West. Like, that's how good they're playing. It's kind of crazy when you look at it. I mean, they're 22-2 since Thanksgiving. 22-2 since Thanksgiving. And, you know, Daryl Morey, the GM of the Houston Rockets, just hit me up on Twitter and said, you know, this is one of the best streaks he's ever seen, or one of the best stretches of basketball he's ever seen, most surprising, I should say.
And how are they doing it?
They're doing it because of spacing. And this is the era of spacing. It's, you know, we have all these sport view cameras that's watching every movement on the court. They're basically tracking every player, the ball, in XY coordinates. And we're getting a lot smarter about the effect of spacing. And we have five guys who can shoot the rock on the floor at all times for the Atlanta Hawks. Every time they play, they got five shooters. And even Al Horford, who is more like, he's like Chris Bosh or Dirk Nowitzki as like a mid-range assassin. He is unbelievably efficient in the mid-range, but they've asked him to step behind the three-point line. So now they have five guys on the floor, along with Taro Antic, as you saw in the playoffs last year, who can shoot threes. And they're basically saying is that this is a market inefficiency. Every player on the floor that comes out for the Atlanta Hawks is going to shoot the rock. And you have Kyle Korver, who's automatic. He's unbelievable. You have Paul Millsap, who's a power forward, shooting 33% from the floor. He has 99 threes on the season. But the spacing, the defense just has no idea how to cover these guys. Because as soon as they get behind the arc, they're an option to shoot. And you're seeing it with Detroit. Like, when Josh Smith left, suddenly they're so much harder to defend because they have so many more shooters out there. So they're definitely surprising everyone in the league. They just, no one knows how to guard them.
I'll also throw out a Spurs East Hawks West complication. Not a complication, confirmation. Without Tim Duncan, how good would the Spurs be? I mean, Tim Duncan, his presence, you know, especially when he was in his prime, made the Spurs and their coach seem like a genius. And it's pretty similar with Al Horford. When Horford was hurt last year, they were a bad team. Now that he's there, he just gives them, he's much more than just the most important player. He's sort of the cog that makes the whole team work, I think.
Yeah, he's so talented, and people don't realize because he plays in Atlanta, but the guy is so skilled. There's only a few, like a handful of bigs in the NBA can go coast to coast, grab a rebound, dribble it down the floor, make a great pass, or finish at the rim. There's just not a lot of guys who can do that. And Al Horford is basically, you know, a three in a five body. And so he's so skilled, so talented. He can shoot, he can pass, he can dribble, and he plays great defense. I mean, when people don't realize, and I just talked slapdashly about their offense, and they're a machine offensively, yes. But defensively, they have the number one defense in the last 20 games. So they're so good defensively because they're long. I mean, Paul Millsap, he's top 10 in steals, and he's a power forward. You just don't see that. He's got extremely long arms for his size. He plays hard. Same with Kyle Korver. I talked to Dwayne Wade a few weeks ago about this. People think that because of what Kyle Korver looks like, he's not a good defender. He's really long. He's really long for a shooting guard, and it's hard for guys to, you know, make passes when they have all that length with Damari Carroll. Al Horford's not tall, but he's really smart on the block there. So they've got a lot of talent offensively, but defensively. The story for me is that they just, no one can score on them, and it's really weird because they don't have that, you know, Tim Duncan, Roy Hibbert type, but they really defend collectively really well. And the thing is, guys, when we talk about the Hawks, they're not just taking advantage of the mess in the East. There's a lot of turnover in the East. You know, as you talked about, the Milwaukee Bucks are up there, but they're not just feasting on the East teams. They've beaten the Blazers, Clippers, Mavs, Grizzlies, Rockets, Pelicans this season. Basically, every Western Conference powerhouse, you know, with the exception of the Golden State Warriors, they haven't played yet, they've beaten them. And so this is a legit title contending team. If they can keep these guys healthy, they're not just, you know, the best in the East. They're up there with the best in the entire NBA.
You know, what comes to my mind is why this wasn't predictable or why nobody really saw this coming. In other sports, you know, you get a Kansas City Royals and it's like surprise, and the surprise team and the darling Cinderella team. In basketball, we tend to sort of know what's going to happen at the beginning of the season. We have a fairly good understanding of the composition and the abilities of teams and how they match up in their particular conferences. When a team comes out of nowhere, it always strikes me as completely confounding. Like, why didn't we know Atlanta was going to be this good?
Yeah, it makes me look bad because it's my job to predict these things. Like, it's one thing to just be like, oh, that's a great story. Like, who saw that coming? Well, our job in the NBA is to be the smartest guys in the room and say, ha-ha, I told you about the Hawks. And the thing about the Hawks, and we'll talk about the Pistons too, but the Hawks, the off-season stuff with Danny Ferry and Bruce Levinson, the whole mess upstairs kind of clouded over the team. So no one was really talking about the fact that Al Horford wasn't playing last year, and they were still a pretty good team that scared the Pacers, brought them to seven games, and the Pacers almost knocked off the Heat. So you're talking about a team that was actually pretty good last year with Al Horford. And the thing is, I thought the bench was going to be worse this year, but Dennis Schroeder, this guy, he's a German, basically a rookie, considering how old he is. He's probably one of the most improved players in the NBA. They call him Baby Rondo. He looks exactly like Rondo, plays like Rondo, and he's such a quick guard, and he was one of the worst NBA players last year, one of the worst. One of the worst players, couldn't play him last year, and he's improved so dramatically that he's one of the best backup point guards in the NBA. He'd help a lot of teams if he started for them. So you got Sabo Cephalosha, Perelantic is a bombing three big man who just no one knows. There's no one like him in the NBA. And they have a depth, they have talent, and they have no one in the top 50 in field goal attempts per game. They share the ball better than any other team in the NBA, even the Spurs. And it's just a pleasure to watch. And unfortunately, not many people are buying into it just because they play in Atlanta.
It's a pleasure to watch, but the Atlanta Media Corps won't be watching them on the road.
they're not sending any beat reporters out to cover the team.
And they being the Atlanta Constitution.
Yeah, or any Atlanta media outlets. So if the Hawks did win a title, which still seems like a bit of a long shot, they would be probably the first team since those Pistons teams of the mid-2000s to win without really having a star. And this Pistons team got rid of the guy that was supposed to be their star, Josh Smith, and have won 8 of 9 games. And it's kind of a similar story, right, Tom, that they're now able to space the floor. They're shooting a ridiculous number of three-pointers per game. And you have a column coming up on ESPN about how Stan Van Gundy, the first-year coach for the Pistons, is basically recreating his great Orlando Magic team that made the finals in 2009.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing to watch. We're all trying to scratch our heads watching the Detroit Pistons. How did they do it? They subtracted a guy and suddenly they're playing, elite basketball. It doesn't really happen all that often. And, Bill Simmons coined the Ewing theory, which is basically when the Knicks didn't have Patrick Ewing back in the day, they soared into the finals. And so there's this coin of, hey, if you lose a star and you play better, that's the Ewing theory. That's Patrick Ewing. That's Rudy Gay. And now we have the Josh Smith theory, right? So Josh Smith, never an all-star, but still, soaked up a lot of possessions, really ugly basketball where they pass it out to the perimeter and he just would ball hog and take a really, really frustrating jumper, mid-range jumper, three-pointer. So he had no business taking. And so what happened was the spacing was crunched. You had five guys hanging out in the paint when every time Josh Smith got the ball and it just completely stagnated the offense. And now without him, they are absolutely killing teams offensively. They're scoring 109.7 points every 100 possessions, which is right up there with the very best in the league. And they're doing it because they're shooting threes. They're just bombing away threes. And Josh Smith, not a good three-point shooter, one of the worst ever. And now they've got guys like Jonas Jerebko or Anthony Tolliver. All these, they're not household names, but they're shooting the rock. Jody Meeks, they're shooting just like, Stan Van Gundy's team did in 2009 when it went to the finals. They're actually shooting more threes than that finals team. And that finals team in 2009 led the NBA in three-point attempts. So this is an amazing transformation. Overnight, when you lose Josh Smith, suddenly everyone seems to know what kind of brand of basketball they want to play, and it's that magic brand of basketball that went to the finals. It's really amazing to watch.
Stan Van Gundy's going to get a lot of credit for changing the offense and getting rid of Josh Smith. But Stan Van Gundy also allowed Josh Smith to dominate the offense for the first X games of the season.
Yeah.
Like, why did that happen? And why should we be not criticizing Van Gundy for not recognizing it sooner or having better control over his team?
I know, right? And sometimes you just wonder if these guys are just unreachable. And maybe Stan Van Gundy tried every trick in his book to try to reach Josh Smith and say, look, you can't do this anymore. I'm not going to play you, or I'm not going to let this happen. I don't know why it didn't work out, but maybe it's just, you know, Josh Smith is saying to Stan, I don't know this for a fact, but I'm getting paid $11 million a year, whatever it is. I can do what I want. And at that point, I mean, the trust is gone, and whatever Stan Van Gundy wanted to do with Josh Smith, if he doesn't want to listen, then there's not much you can do. So it is interesting, though. He could have just, like, sent Josh Smith home and just said, don't be with the team. We'll trade you. Stay at home. We're going to move on without you. And they could have gotten something in return for him. But Stan Van Gundy said no. I mean, he's the president of basketball ops there. So not only is the coach, but he has all veto power on any move. So he basically sent him home, cut him, and got nothing back in return. And now he's looking really smart. But it does raise the question, why didn't this happen sooner?
How much stock, Tom, do you put into the argument that once you cut your floundering best player, you're lighting a fire under the other guys, the motivation argument here?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's tough. I mean, it seems like, you know, hindsight is 20/20 a lot of the time. But it really, a guy like Josh Smith is really poisonous to a team because he's not efficient. He makes a ton of money. So it seems like, you know, he's a quote unquote leader of the team. And so he can kind of kill the locker room that way. But we just never see, you know, a transformation like this. And even with Kobe Bryant this year, they were so much better when he went to the bench. But he was able, right now what you're seeing when he plays, he was able to kind of evolve his game into not, you know, shooting every time he touched the ball, a contested mid-range jumper every time he touched the ball. But Josh Smith, you know, he just, I guess, wasn't able to do that. He wasn't willing to evolve. So, you know, no one's going to say they should cut Kobe Bryant, but these guys have to have a capacity to change. And if they don't, then maybe they do have to cut them. But you know, Josh Smith, I think what we're seeing in Detroit, part of the reason why it's so amazing to watch, because it's so rare. We just never see this happen. So it's amazing to see.
But I think it also has to do with human nature. And you get rid of this guy, and everybody else on the team suddenly is having fun. It's like, oh, we can play basketball. We can shoot three-point shots. We like doing that. And now we have the opportunity to do it.
You got to hand it to Stan Van Gundy because you got to keep that locker room together to have that trust between Brandon Jennings and between Andre Drummond, who's just a monster, and to keep them focused because it's a really young team and they love playing basketball right now, obviously without Josh Smith. And it's just, you got to hand it to them. And this is an unbelievable stretch for them.
So quickly, the story of this season really is, you know, the number of guys, star players in the league who've missed a huge amount of time. You made a list on ESPN, guys that have missed more than five games to injury. It would take the entire rest of our podcast to list them all. But Kobe, LeBron, Kevin Durant, Carmelo Anthony, Russell Westbrook, Paul George, Dwight Howard, Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade, Joakim Noah, Tony Parker, and so forth. Is this finally going to scare Adam Silver in the league office into saying, like, you know, we don't want to give up the revenue of like 82 games in a year, but we also don't want to have all of this like dead money not playing and all of the most famous best players not on the court and fans having to watch these like shelves of teams basically.
Yeah. And it's one thing for them to not play and it's another to make noise about it. So before the season, Dirk Nowitzki and LeBron James, two of the biggest stars, one international, one, you know, American player saying, we need to play fewer games. And the reflexive reaction to a lot of people, the knee-jerk reaction is like, oh, yeah, well, where are they going to make up the money? Like, next time you ask a player, like, do you want to play fewer games, ask them, do you want to take a smaller paycheck? Because if you cut off the games, if you, you know, kill 15 games off the schedule, that's 15 games of revenue that they're losing. But I don't really think that's the case. I think there's some value in scarcity. And if you look at the NFL or you look at the NCAA March Madness tournament, I mean, in 11 broadcasts, Kevin Arnovitz at ESPN found this out, in 11 broadcast dates for March Madness, the NBA gets more revenue. I mean, the NCAA gets more revenue over those 11 broadcast dates than the NBA does for an entire NBA season. So there is value in scarcity, and less is more. And I think they might not have less revenue. I think they might have more because these games matter. So when the CBA comes around in 2017, this is going to be a hot-button issue. If LeBron James, if the likes of LeBron James and Kobe Bryant and all these guys miss games because they don't have enough rest in the schedule, it's going to be a big deal.
But if you don't let all 29 other teams a chance to beat up the Sixers and the Knicks, it's not fair.
Hey, the Sixers have won two in a row.
it's true. Actually, I'll leave you with this. I know we're running late here, but I'll leave you with this. The Knicks have had only 1 minute in the last 15 games where they've held a lead greater than 5 points. So they've had 1 minute of basketball where they've had a lead greater than 5 points. It's insane.
Don't worry, they lost that game.
It's crazy. The Knicks and the 76ers, I mean, we keep talking about these guys and these refs, but every time they play those teams, it seems like they're getting rest the night off, right?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Tom Haberstroh.
All right, guys. Take it easy. Thanks for having me on.
I am pleased to announce a live event coming up in New York that you might be interested in. You should join the writers and editors behind Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog, for an evening of conversation about the latest gay news, culture, and controversy. It is happening Tuesday, February 3rd, City Winery in New York. Slate's J. Brian Lauder, Mark Joseph Stern, and June Thomas will be there. And they will have a special guest, actress Leah DeLaria, who plays Big Boo on Orange is the New Black. And at the end of the evening, audience members will have an opportunity to pose their very own Ask a Homo question. That is Tuesday, February 3rd at City Winery in New York. We have done shows at that venue. It is a great one. For more information, you can go to slate.com/outwardnyc. As we tape the podcast this morning, climbers Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen have been hanging on what's known as the Dawn Wall of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park for 17 days. Caldwell and Jorgensen are trying to complete the first free ascent of the more than 3,000-foot-high Dawn Wall, what Caldwell recently called the steepest, blankest big wall in the world, and what the New York Times' John Branch called smooth as alabaster, as steep as the bedroom wall, more than a half mile tall. A free ascent is a climb that's free of aid, which our guest Andrew Bisharat will explain to us. In a recent piece for National Geographic, Andrew wrote that if Caldwell and Jorgensen are successful in free climbing the Dawn Wall, it will be one of the most significant climbing achievements of all time. Andrew is a writer and climber based in Colorado. He's been writing about the ascent, and he's been talking to the climbers as they make their way up. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Josh.
Sure. And let's start with the basics. What are these climbers doing, and what is a free ascent?
Well, a free ascent means free of aid. And what that really means is using your hands and feet to ascend only the natural features presented by the rock. So it's a differentiation from aid climbing, where climbers would place a piece of gear, such as a piton, a bolt, or a cam, and they would hang on it and clip a nylon ladder to that piece of gear and stand on that, place the next piece of gear, place another nylon ladder, walk up the ladder, and continue up that way. So free climbing is a much more pure form of rock climbing. It's much more enjoyable, and it's much more challenging because you have to basically just use the strengths in your physical, in your hands and feet, to climb the wall.
And it's different from free soloing, which you don't have any rope at all. And if you did that and climbed the Dawn Wall, you would die, because when you fall, if you fall, there's no rope to catch you.
And they fall, pretty regularly, right?
Yeah, they fall all the time. So as climbs get harder, as free climbs get harder, you're exactly right. It's really just a matter of using ropes, using gear, but not weighting it and not using it to progress upward. And so the ropes and the gear are there to protect the climbers. The challenge is not just getting to the top of the wall. The challenge is to do all the moves as a free climb.
And let's be clear that this isn't like these guys just looked up from the bottom of the Dawn Wall and said, let's give it a shot. This has been like 7 years in the making, and every route is precisely mapped out. They've actually been up on the wall many, many times. Can you explain the process of preparing to tackle something like this?
Sure. And that's really what makes this ascent so significant, is that it's taken Tommy Caldwell 7 years just to put himself in a position where he might be successful. There's about 100 routes on El Cap in total, and 12 of those, only 12 are free climbs, and Tommy has done 11 of them. And he's done them all pretty quickly. So the fact that this has taken him 7 years, first to find the route and then to actually work on the moves and be able to free climb it, really speaks to the difficulty of this ascent. you know, typically on El Capitan, there are vertical cracks that are very obvious from the ground, and that typically has been where the majority of the free climbs are located. So you look up, you see a vertical crack. It runs from the bottom all the way to the top of the wall. What makes the Don Wall different is that it's one of the first routes that's really broken away from the vertical crack systems and gone onto these completely blank faces that look just impossible. But, you know, over the years, as Tom's gone on rappel, he's rappelled down the wall, he's swung around, he's looked to find, oh, there's a little hold here, there's a foothold here. You know, and imagine doing this on a 3,000-foot cliff. He's been able to find a way to link moves up this wall that just looks completely impossible.
And literally, how does he mark it? When he's done all that rappelling, how does he mark where the holds are and where the optimal route would be?
Well, a lot of it is just memorization, and a lot of it involves, establishing the anchor points, which in this case are bolts that he drills into the cliff. And he has to do this by hand because power drilling is illegal in national parks. But using a hand drill, which takes about 45 minutes just to place one bolt, you know, he's able to establish these anchors in order to keep the climbing relatively safe. You know, it's still quite dangerous, but relatively safe so that if he falls, he's not going to die or really injure himself gravely. So the first 2 years of his process was really about putting in the bolts, you know, finding where the holds are. Sometimes they'll use little dabs of chalk called tick marks to indicate where, you know, footholds and handholds are, which, you know, that'll typically wash away after one rainstorm. So it's still, you know, every time they go up there, it's still a matter of, oh, we have to remember where the holds are. But for guys like Tommy Caldwell and Kevin Jorgensen, a lot of it is, I mean, they're just such gifted climbers that even without all of that, they can, on some of the easier pitches, they can really, you know, just climb as if it's their first time on the wall.
So following this, a couple questions. It seems like it's true that Caldwell is making better progress than Jorgensen. Jorgensen, I think, hurt himself more seriously. Is it possible that Caldwell will finish it and Jorgensen won't be able to join him? And also, I've been reading about the ratings of the difficulty, and it seems like 5.13 is a number that's thrown out there. But then from the point they're at now, it's all 5.12 or easier. What do those numbers correlate to? Is that like the Richter scale? Like every one is difficult as the last? Yeah,
that is the, that is what we call in climbing the Yosemite decimal system. And what that indicates is that it sort of grows out of this idea of rating hikes. So a class one hike is just a flat walk. Class three hike is, you know, you have to start scrambling and use your hands. When you get to class five, that's considered technical rock climbing, where you need ropes and equipment to safely ascend the, you know, so-called hike. So within this fifth class, it's broken down by a decimal point system. So instead of 5.12, we would say 5.12. So it's an open-ended system that begins at 5.1, goes up to 5.15C, which is the hardest climb in the world right now. And the climb, the ratings of the hardest pitches on the Don Wall are 5.14D, which is just a few notches below the very world standard. And the fact that
What would be harder, Andrew? Going upside down?
Well, certainly, yeah. The steeper it gets, the harder the climbing gets. You know, this is a very unique style of climbing because it's on a vertical wall. It involves very small holds, very precarious movements, a lot of balance, and just an incredible sense of your space and your body awareness on this vertical cliff. There are routes that are technically harder than the Don Wall, but none are as sustained or as long.
And do you think that Caldwell could do it without his partner?
He's certainly in a position where he is, you know, poised to strike the summit. He could have been on top a few days ago, but he chose to give Kevin more time to catch up. He was battling some finger skin tears that was really stopping him at one pitch, pitch 15.
I think you described it, or he described it as like grabbing razor blades.
Certainly, yeah. That's no exaggeration. That some of these holds are as sharp as razor blades, and you know, when you have to work on doing the moves and you're doing it over and over and you're continuing to grab these really sharp blades of rock, of course that, you know, leaves some damage in your skin. But now Kevin has broken through on the hardest pitches, and today the plan is for him to finish the last 513 pitches. And once he does that, he and Tommy will be at the same height, and we're hoping that they'll top out by Wednesday.
And to be clear, there is some, they need each other. I mean, I think part of Caldwell's, partly it's his ethos of wanting to support his teammate, but there's assistance here.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they're blaming each other, even though it's kind of confusing because we say that Tommy's so far ahead of Kevin, but they're still belaying each other. They're still climbing together, and they're able to move up and down this wall via a system of rigged ropes. And so really, you know, climbing has progressed because it used to be a matter of, I just want to get to the top of this cliff. And in Yosemite especially, it was all about just finding a way just to get to the top by whatever means necessary. Well, now the adventure is really about how you get there. And that's what Kevin and Tommy are trying to do. They're trying to do this with all three. And so it's not just about getting to the top, which, you know, they could do in an hour if they really wanted. It's they want to stay on the wall and free climb each pitch in succession together and stand on top successful together.
And this is the part of the podcast, Andrew, where the host asks the guest the big picture, what does it all mean question, to telegraph that a little bit. What is it about El Capitan? What is it about this particular route, this particular climb, you know, this being one of the most significant climbing achievements ever? If Tommy had decided, I want to spend 7 years mapping out a route in some other national park or in some other, like, really difficult climb, like, what is it about this man, this, you know, cliff in this place that combines to make it so significant?
Well, I mean, I think the real answer to that question is that it's not significant. He's not curing cancer. He's not, you know, solving any major problem in the world. This is like a very selfish endeavor in a lot of ways. But within this ascent, I think that there's a lot of really important themes to, you know, people in our modern times. And that's, you know, being dedicated to a big goal, being passionate about something, and seeing it through, even if it takes, you know, over 7 years to do, and you just get beat down and beat down year after year. And I think that that's what has really captivated, you know, sort of general population, you know, and forced them to sort of look into a little microcosm that is rock climbing. And I think that it also helps because El Capitan is like the center stage in the climbing world. So it's a very public cliff. It's right by the road. And, you know, you can just look up and see these climbers battling away day after day.
It's also produced some stunning images. I mean, holy cow, these guys like sleeping and eating and pooping up there, but also aren't images of them pooping up there, actually. And the videos are remarkable. They've got looks like they've got a video team and photographers documenting all of this. And I think what's also appealing here is that Tommy Caldwell has a pretty interesting backstory. I mean, I was reading this profile from outside from 2002, and you've repeated the story, as have others, that he and some other climbers were kidnapped in the mountains of Kyrgyzstan by rebel fighters, and Caldwell threw one of these guys off of a cliff in order to save the party.
Yeah,
I think that was the movie Cliffhanger, starring Sylvester Stallone.
That is a true story, and it was a big part of Tommy's life, and, you know, I think it really just speaks to what a hero this guy is, and the fact that, you know, nobody's really heard of him has always been a source of pride in the climbing world, because it's like, wow, we have this guy who's, you know, who's done all this incredible rock climbing. He's such a humble person. He never speaks ill of anyone. You know, he gets as much enjoyment watching other people succeed as he does himself. And he just couldn't be a better, you know, ambassador for the sport of climbing.
He is an indie rock star. Andrew, thank you so much. You said Wednesday could be the day. We'll be following your reports on National Geographic. We'll be looking for the videos. Hopefully they'll do something cool at the top, if not cure cancer, maybe at least like raise their fist in triumph.
We hope so. Thank you so much.
All right, now it is time for After Balls. after climbs, after cliffs. I like Yosemite Decimal System.
Yeah.
Andrew gave a good explanation for that. I think this podcast has been about a 5.3a.
We'd have to ask the members of the rock climbing section of the Angeles chapter of the Sierra Club, which developed the Yosemite Decimal System.
All right. Well, while I wait to get them on the line, Mike Pesca, what is your Yosemite Decimal System?
Some of these segments we've discussed are like razor blades, like literally grabbing razor blades, to which 99% of humanity would say, don't do it. But the 1% that does, we laud or put in institutions. So I speak today, not of that, but of the national championship game. When you hear this, it maybe will have been played. It maybe will have been over. And of course, the championship game for so many years has concluded with the awarding of an ergonomically ridiculous egg. We see Jimbo Fisher raising the egg. We see Nick Saban raising the egg in our mind's eye. But that Waterford Crystal egg, technically the American Football Coaches Association trophy, has gone away. It will not be awarded in the championship game. Instead, a trophy that looks a lot like two parentheses around some train tracks while they're trying to evoke football will be awarded. So what happened to the egg? Will it just be put in storage? Oh, no. They have a plan for the egg. And by the way, the egg, the branded sponsor of the egg, is like a walk through the devolution of corporate America. So Pepsi started off as a sponsor. I think they probably have a bigger market cap than the successor, McDonald's. McDonald's then sponsored the egg. Oh, and walk with me as we go down the list of corporations to sponsor the egg. Then Sears became a sponsor. Then Circuit City became a sponsor. Then ADT became a sponsor. And now it seems that Dr. Pepper is sponsoring the trophy, but not really. They just got on board when it was going to be a national championship trophy. Now the Waterford Crystal Egg is being sponsored by Amway. But what about this egg? Who gets the egg? Do they just give it to the winning team afterwards? Not on the field? No. The Waterford Crystal Coaches Trophy will be awarded to the final team that was voted number one in the coaches poll. The coaches poll, by the way, was not at all a factor in determining who got to play in the playoffs. So the coaches are holding on to their poll. The coaches are holding on to their egg. And later, holding on to their egg in a ceremony after the national championship game is played, for some reason, Nick Saban of Alabama will be getting the egg. Now, Alabama, when they actually deserve the egg, when they won championships, how did they treat the egg? Well, in 2012, the Waterford Crystal sculpture that was in Alabama's facility, having been won on the field, was shattered. Now, I'll read a series of articles and statements about the shattering of this egg. Officials aren't releasing the name of the man who tripped and stumbled. Cut to a day later. Alabama says Carlton Tinker, parent of tied long snapper Carson Tinker, tripped on a rug and knocked over the egg. And then when Carlton Tinker was interviewed, no, there was no rug. Here's the quote. I don't know if I bumped the table when I turned around or if my foot caught on the large tablecloth they had draped and puddled on the floor. What are you doing puddling a tablecloth under a $30,000 egg? Anyway, this egg, given by a vote of coaches to a team that is just really bitter, will apparently still occur after the national championship game is played with two teams, not including Alabama. Congratulations. You win the egg.
I meant to say at the top of the show, we're not talking about the championship game because they had the temerity to schedule it on a Monday.
Yeah.
How dare they?
Yeah.
And there's nothing that can be done. What can we do? Stefan, what is your Yosemite Decimal System?
You know what I love, Josh? I loved bowling on ABC's Wide World of Sports.
Chris Schenkel.
Brooklyn's own Johnny Petraglia. Square Earl Anthony. So it warms my heart for about 5 seconds anyway until I change the channel. Whenever I stumble across some Professional Bowlers Association bowling on ESPN these days, and if you did some stumbling over the past few weeks on the Geico PBA World Series of Bowling VI, that's six, which concluded yesterday with the PBA World Championship from the new state-of-the-art South Point Bowling Plaza in Las Vegas, then you may have caught one of the PBA's Animal Pattern Championships. Bowlers among you no doubt are familiar with the Animal Pattern Championships. I was not, because, as I mentioned, I haven't paid attention to bowling since Johnny Petraglia was winning the 1977 Bowling Proprietors Association of America U.S. Open, and I was bowling at Bowlerland in the Bronx just over the border from Pelham, not far from Corvettes, with my friend Kojak, who you might remember from my stickball escapades on the call-in show. So when I read on the PBA website that ESPN audiences for the Cheetah, Viper, Chameleon, and Scorpion championships were up over the previous year, I thought maybe the lanes were painted with the images of these animals. But no, the animal patterns are oil patterns on the lanes, lane conditions. Every lane on which you bowl is oiled, and the amount of oil applied and the pattern or shape in which it is applied affects everything. Speed and spin of the ball, but also the weight and composition of the ball that a bowler chooses. A typical bowling alley oils 38 to 40 feet of the 60-foot lane, with almost all of the oil toward the center of the lane, which helps funnel off-target balls back toward the pocket, which makes bowling more fun for you and me. The PBA says that pattern can inflate pro averages by 20 to 50 pins a game, so it mixes up the patterns to force bowlers to adjust. In 2005, the PBA introduced five patterns: Chameleon, Cheetah, Scorpion, Shark, and Viper, and it named tournaments after the patterns. In 2013, the PBA added three more patterns, the Badger, Bear, and Wolf. Each pattern requires a different approach. Here's an excerpt from a PBA video explaining how to attack the Scorpion, which applies oil to 43 feet of the lane.
Typically, you will want to use a more aggressive bowling ball on this pattern. Power players will start further inside than strokers or tweeners. The break point for all styles of play should be in the track area of the lane. While the Scorpion pattern may be the closest to your typical house pattern, it is much flatter, and you may need to use a different ball.
You can really divide the world into strokers and tweeners. That's what I always say.
And power players. And power players. I don't know what any of that means. I'm not going to try to figure it out. There are charts and graphs all over the web about these patterns, but I was intrigued by the names, and fortunately the PBA's website offers details on how each animal name fits its particular pattern. The Scorpion is 47 feet of, as you might expect, oily terror. Quote, "A scorpion is dangerous and unpredictable, like this pattern. If you can't find the right groove on the lanes, you'll be stung. The viper is just 39 feet, but a viper strikes with multiple angles of attack. This pattern will challenge players to attack the pins from multiple angles in order to score well. The 43-foot chameleon, as you might guess, requires bowlers to adapt. Chameleons change color to outsmart their enemies. To excel on this pattern, bowlers must be versatile in many styles of play. I think my favorite, though, is the shark, also 43 feet. This pattern forces bowlers to play deep inside the center of the lanes, like sharks that troll the depths of the ocean." Scary shark. All right, now the badger, the bear, and the wolf patterns do not have descriptions on the PBA website. This needs to change. I've got some suggestions. You guys are free to come up with your own. Badger. The badger is fat and dumb and mindlessly digs holes in the ground. If you chuck the ball down the middle and hope for the best, the 52-foot-long badger is the pattern for you. The wolf. The wolf marks its territory by urinating and defecating. It might be just 32 feet in length, but the wolf pattern will have you soiling your bowling slacks in fear. And finally, the bear. Like a hiker who forgets his bell and leaves a bag of gorp outside his tent, the 40-foot-long bear will rip the limbs off of the careless bowler and scatter pieces of his carcass from gutter to gutter.
I got one.
That's quite violent.
Bowling is violent. It's aggressive. It's the bear, man.
I got one.
Go ahead.
The spiny anteater. The spiny anteater is known as being one of two animals that do not have the ability to dream, just as most bowlers must give up their hopes and ambitions and embrace the 10-pin.
It has been enacted for the next big tournament, the spiny anteater.
It's all yours, PBA. Josh, what's your Yosemite decimal system?
Who, Stefan, also Mike, also people, holds the men's NCAA Division I basketball record for most points scored in a game against a fellow Division I team, Division I on Division I action? I would pause to let you answer, but I've got to move on. We're busy people. For a while, it was Pete Maravich, who scored 69 for LSU against Alabama in 1970. But U.S. internationals Kevin Bradshaw broke Pistol Pete's record in 1991. officially scoring 72 points on 23 of 59 shooting against Loyola Marymount in a 186-140 loss. This was a 40-minute game. According to a contemporaneous LA Times article by Alan Drews, Bradshaw actually scored 73 points, but by the time the scoring discrepancy was discovered, he was already officially in the books with 72. Oh, well.
No way to correct it.
Nope. In a 2012 ESPN.com story, U.S. Internationals coach Gary Zarecki explained that he wanted his team to play fast and score a lot of points as a recruiting tool. But Bradshaw's high-scoring game was really the only thing that went right for the U.S. international goals that season, as they finished with a 2-26 record. Not great for recruiting. Actually, that was not even close to being the worst of it. 2 weeks before Bradshaw's record game, the school declared bankruptcy. The LA Times reported that U.S. International had $14 million in debt in the U.S. and another $8.5 million in debt across campuses in Mexico City, London, and Nairobi. Perhaps not surprisingly, this debt was related to the school's international expansion. The basketball team alone among the school's athletic programs was allowed to finish its season, though they had to practice in a warehouse. In another story, the LA Times wrote that Coach Zarecki brought in a man with terminal cancer to give the team a motivational speech, after which the goals lost by 40 in front of 223 fans.
But it was international cancer, and the warehouse housed international goods.
Zarecki's response after this loss, "I told my players, at least they're not in Saudi Arabia." Love that guy.
International reference. I love it.
The team did win one game after its bankruptcy. The LA Times wrote on February 15th, 1991, among the 277 fans who celebrated U.S. International's 98-96 victory Thursday over Cal State Northridge was one woman whose voice cut through, hollering like a knife, "Oh my God, we won." That's a good fan.
Loyal fan.
U.S. International is now a part of Alliant International University, which was created in 2001 and does not have a basketball team. Coach Gary Zarecki is now a PE instructor at De Anza College in Cupertino, California. On ratemyprofessors.com, his reviews range from "this class is the worst PE class" to "Coach Z was a coach in the tougher neighborhoods back in the days and got some of the really good basketball players where they are today. Come and play basketball in his class because it's pretty fun." ESPN.com did a write-up on Bradshaw in 2012. He started out playing at Bethune-Cookman before dropping out and joining the Navy. He played on an all-armed forces team with David Robinson. He then went back to college at U.S. International when he was in his mid-20s. He never got an NBA tryout. He did play in Israel for 12 years, where he once scored 101 points in a game. He is the subject of a documentary called Shooting for Home, which focuses on how he overcame a bunch of dark periods in his life, including thoughts of suicide, and has now become a happy family man. He is now coaching at San Diego's King Chavez Community High School, which lost its most recent game by the score of 91-11. At that pace, they will match their coach's single-game scoring record after 5.5 more games. We love your feedback on what we talked about today.
Before you say that, can I just ask,
Mike,
why would having some guy who takes all the shots be a good recruiting tool?
Because every recruit would be like, well, I would be the best player, so I would get all the shots.
Oh, I see. I thought he was
We get to
there.
Practice in a warehouse, and they have people with terminal cancer come talk to us.
Right, yeah. At least he didn't say, at least you guys don't have terminal cancer after that game.
Yeah. Coach Zarecki, motivational speaker. You can email us, resuming the credits, at hangup@slate.com. We'll also gather links to the stories we discussed at slate.com/hangup. Subscribe to Hang Up and listen in iTunes. You can find us at itunes.com/slatepodcasts. And when you're there, please leave us a comment and a rating. Become a fan of Hang Up and Listen on Facebook at facebook.com/hangupandlisten. Our producer is Mike Volo. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. And the executive producer of Slate's podcast is Andy Bowers. Remember Zalmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.